Okay, hi everyone. I'm Aaron Watts. I am the Media, Cable, Satellite, Business Services, Credit Research Analyst at Deutsche Bank. I'm joined on the stage by Kevin Latek, the Chief Legal and Development Officer at Gray Television. Kevin, thank you for being here again this year.
I'll start. We're webcasting this, so I'll quote Donald Trump and thank the 2 million people who are in the conference room right now. Okay. So thank you all for coming out at last minute edition.
Exactly. So there's been a lot going on this past year in the space. I'm glad we have a chance to sit down here to discuss not only Gray, but also industry themes as a whole. And I do want to start with current events. And I think it's fair to say there's been a decent amount of hand-wringing that's gone on, centered around the Disney charter dispute, which ultimately got settled a couple weeks ago. As we've now had time for that dust to settle, it would be great to hear your thoughts on the new template for the two companies, which obviously includes both D2C and linear, and seems to preserve the cable bundle for now, what it means for local broadcasters broadly, what it means for Gray specifically.
Sure. Obviously, we've gotten a question or two on Charter Disney the last few weeks. I don't think Gray in particular benefits any more or less than other broadcasters, so my answer is really generally the Charter Disney outcome is very good for local broadcasters. I'd say it is the best thing that's happened for broadcast retrans since the Supreme Court threw out the Aereo case a few years ago. I'm particularly bullish on the outcome because I've been involved in retrans in cable programming for over 25 years. I can tell you the MVPDs have long wanted to get tiering flexibility, the ability to bundle channels in ways that appeal to consumers' desires as opposed to just the big super bundles that would allow them to provide products that are more attuned to each individual customer. That not just brings the cost down, but it makes the product more appealing. If I could, I would have a Comcast subscription that did not include any sports at all, and another other people that would gladly have a Comcast subscription that didn't include any news channels at all. But that's at this point, we're obviously all locked into that world. So if the MVPDs eventually had the ability to create more tailored bundles at smaller price points, that should not only keep people in the bundle in the pay TV ecosystem, I think it brings them back. So that's absolutely good for us. Broadcasters are very aligned with the traditional MVPDs in maintaining subscriber levels. Adding the additional value of DTC apps, again, provides another reason for people to stay in the bundle and not leave, which is good for broadcasters. And finally, we saw a further and very loud reaffirmation of the allocation of the programming budget, reallocation of the programming budget away from the channels that have low viewership and low appeal to the high-valued, more highly watched, more highly valuable channels. So we know ESPN and ABC are getting paid more. We know channels that weren't getting watched are no longer being carried. That's really not a new trend. We've seen other companies focus on smaller number of cable channels the last few years. We've seen some channels shut down. I've not seen Disney really narrow its focus before this deal. So I think it's a reaffirmation of the strong programming deserves to get paid better and will get paid better, and we'll have an ecosystem that is stronger as a result. My only sad point is it'll probably take a couple years for the MVPDs and the content companies to work through a framework that looks just like Charter Disney, but I'll leave with my headline. I think the Charter Disney framework is the best thing to happen to broadcast retrans since the Supreme Court struck down Aereo.
Okay, so it sounds like you believe this can help reduce cord shaving, cord cutting. Maybe also remind us what your sub churn has been hovering around and where what you're modeling for going forward.
Yeah, our sub trends are pretty consistent with, I think, everybody else in the industry. The traditionals are declining faster than we would like. The virtuals have been growing quickly the last several years, especially as they rolled out into new markets. And importantly, as broadband penetration hits mid-sized, smaller markets, rural areas, the virtuals become more of a substitute to the traditional operators, and they've seen the virtual sub numbers increase. That has slowed down. One, they're getting just a point of, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's saturation, but they're coming up with a much bigger number, so the growth rate's going to slow. I don't think our numbers are particularly any different than others. It probably were for a while when Gray was primarily a mid-market and small market company. With the addition of Meredith 2 years ago, we are now in a slew of very large markets. So we are pretty well balanced between the Atlanta, Phoenix type markets, as well as the North Platte and Waco's and Topeka's of the world.
A question that came up a lot around that topic was how traditional cable satellite bundle subscriber economics compare to virtual streaming subscribers for you. And, you know, connected to that, I know there's been a push in D.C. Around the local broadcasters getting more control over negotiating with virtuals directly. Any line of sight on that or timing to a positive outcome?
Look, it's Washington. I assume you all got the news alert about what happened in Washington in the last 2 hours, so I think it's safe to say that nothing much is going to happen in Washington anytime soon on anything that actually matters. And media policy issues are low on the priority list. That said, the Disney charter dispute and the broadcast coalition that formed this summer have together shown a lot of folks in Washington who knew about the virtual or the streaming loophole, allow them to understand what it would mean if Disney had taken off every ABC affiliate in the country, including all of ours, from the charter platform. Those who hadn't heard of the issue at least know of the issue, so it's certainly getting more traction. With Washington, everything takes longer than it should and is more complicated than it should. So I can't give you a timeline, but I feel very confident in time we are going to regain our rights and the bleeding of our revenues to the networks will cease.
Okay. And then the economics, are they relatively even, virtual versus?
I don't mean to be a contrarian, but I'm kind of tired of talking about reverse comp. I think that term is antiquated. In 2008, we started getting retrans revenue as an industry. And about 2008 in a day, the network said, hey, where's our share? And so we had a bunch of battles with the networks for a couple years until they got their share of our retrans revenue. For a long time, our network compensation was directly related to what we got in retrans. That's not the case anymore. It's not the case for Gray, and I'm pretty sure I'm hearing from my peers it's not the case either. We pay the networks a fee. We pay the syndicators a fee. We buy other programming for a fee. It has nothing to do with whether I have $1 billion in retrans revenue or I have $0 in retrans revenue. So my retrans revenue comes in from a couple of different platforms. Some are very similar to others. Some are very different than others. The economics vary for a variety of reasons, in part as to who's controlling the negotiation. And we pay a bunch of fixed fees for programming. Very little of that is actually variable based on our retrans numbers. So at this point, I can take our programming expense or our network comp expense or, frankly, our personnel expense, and I can subtract it from any revenue line I want to get any kind of margin you want. And to me, it's fairly meaningless. It's all spreadsheet math. So I'm happy to do it. We have disclosed our network comp for years. I think we probably disclose more than anybody else, and you're welcome to take that margin and apply it to our gross retrans. If you would like to make an assumption of what our OTT revenue is, you can subtract it or divide it from that. You can take our personnel costs and divide it from our gross retrans. To me, it's fairly meaningless. We are getting compensated below market from every single distributor. In time, that will be fixed, but right now, every single distributor is undercompensating us. We are paying the networks too much money. In time, that will right itself. And we're doing okay, I think, on the ad business, and certainly we can talk about that. Retrans is in a state of flux. It has been since it was created in 93, and the broadcasters got nothing for a long, long time. So we're going through a multi-decade process of fixing and getting fairly compensated for our content. We still have a ways to go. I'm very happy about where we've gone so far, but we have a ways to go, and I'm not terribly hung up on what margins and what fixed costs we subtract from other variable revenue lines.
Okay. You had mentioned one of the threats that got put out there during the dispute was about dropping all ABCs, right? And I know ABC only represents a small percentage of your stations. I think it's around 12% of them. But the question I wanted to ask was, ABC seems as impacted, if not the most impacted, of any of the major networks of taking content off of ABC and moving it to ESPN or to other cable networks. Is that a trend that you see slowing down now, or do you expect that to continue?
When we sat here in 2015, we spent a long time talking about Monday Night Football moving to ESPN, and it was the end of the world because Monday Night Football had moved to ESPN, and ABC was not going to be able to get retrans any longer. Certainly that was not the case. We have spent a lot of time worrying about the exclusivity as affiliates. We talk a lot about exclusivity, obviously internally, talk a lot about exclusivity with the networks. We still have a value proposition that's very strong for the distributors. Monday Night Football has become an ESPN product. We're very happy to see it. It's been simulcast on ABC. Until recently, ABC was the least valuable network when it came to retransmission. In our retrans negotiations, I would say we had different conversations about our ABC stations as opposed to our non-ABC stations. Our ABC stations tend to have very, very strong local news, which means they tend to have people who are changing the channel when they get done watching a CBS program or something on Netflix or something on even ION or Fox, and they switch to our ABC for local news. But they weren't watching the ABC Prime, and they weren't getting essentially any sports out of ABC. I'd say to ABC's credit and Disney's credit, they've been hearing the complaints from the affiliates since about 2015 on this topic. They are moving more sports back to ABC. Obviously, college sports have made a big move back to ABC in the last several months, and going forward, there'll be a lot more. In our negotiations with retrans with MVPDs this year, we have seen an appreciation for ABC that we had not seen in a couple years. ABC is largely at parity with our other networks in terms of compensation in the most recent negotiations. I think that's a testament to Disney putting more sports back on it. What we're seeing when we take a step back is I think sports teams and leagues in general are seeing the value of the reach. You're just even in the last couple weeks, we're talking about ratings of sports, in particular NFL, as it's in college football on Saturday night, as it's hitting broadcast. The audience is very large, much larger than they can get on TNT, obviously ESPN and the others. Broadcast is offering not just a way to help monetize the rights, which is terribly important, but expand the reach. And if you're a team owner, you probably want more fans rather than fewer fans. The best way to create more fans is to get your programming out there so people can watch it. And getting the programs on broadcast has been great for the teams. That's why Gray and all of our peers, including the networks with their O&O groups, are talking with teams and leagues about picking up professional sports games to bring it back to broadcast, increase the reach, increase the value for the teams in the sport. So I think we'll continue to see sports moving likely back to ABC. Even in the last 2 weeks, you all have seen that Monday Night Football will now be simulcast every week on ABC. That's a huge improvement from where we were 2 or 3 years ago, and that has, at least in our experience, helped us in our retrans negotiations. So I think to bring this full circle, not just a Disney charter deal, but what we're seeing in our experience is from talking to basketball teams and hockey leagues, et cetera, is we're seeing a recognition of the value of broadcast as a destination of choice for people who want to get the content out. And that means I am, at least, and our company remains very bullish on our prospects for retrans. The Charter-Disney deal creates a better framework for us going forward. But overall, we've got the better content. We've got the reach. We have the brand-safe businesses in these local markets. People are tuning to us, and they're going to see more sports on broadcast in the coming years. And that just makes us more valuable.
So with the dispute, there's been a line of rhetoric that maybe distributors now are the leverage is tilting their way on negotiating for these types of deals going forward, distribution deals going forward. Do you feel that that's the case, that there's some tilting back to the distributors on pricing power or whatever metric you'd like to put it in? And I ask that because you've had 40% of your subs up this year. You've got another 60% up next year. So as you enter those negotiations, is the dynamic changing?
Absolutely not. Our retrans renewals that we have done this year included one of the two satellite companies and two of the largest cable companies. The conversations are never easy. They're not fun. We're not out for a game of golf with these guys, but they know us. They've negotiated with my colleague who's been doing retrans with me since 1997 at a law firm before we came to Gray. We have good relations. We have our talking points. They talk about exclusivity. We talk about reach. We talk about ratings. They talk about exclusivity. We talk about how many people will instantly drop them if they don't have our local talent in their markets. They talk about exclusivity, and we get a deal done. We've achieved the next incremental round of price increases that we expected going into those negotiations and that we expect to continue to get going forward. There are talking points. We don't make threats in our negotiations. I think, you know, you've seen in Gray's retrans history, four or 500 negotiations every 3 years. We've had one blackout 9 years ago with Cox the last 4 days and three DMAs, and we've renewed with them two, if not three times since. We can get it done. And not to put other folks on the spotlight at all, but I'm not seeing a change in the distributor leverage. I think that dialogue or that narrative is coming from people who have never actually done a retrans negotiation, or they're coming from the talking points of the MVPDs.
Okay. So one last question around Disney Charter, and that has to do with whether this new template now makes it possible or easier for distributors and their subscribers to access network content, including nationally televised sports and especially the NFL, even if there is a dispute going on with the local affiliate. The obvious implications being a distributor may not feel as compelled or feel the pressure to meet your asking price if there's a way to get around you, in essence. So I'm just curious if you can talk about that. What are your exclusivity protections, and has that changed at all recently?
Now, a distributor in a traditional MVPD talking about retrans with us and say, you know, if I drop you, I'll just tell everybody to go get your signal because your simulcast, it's being offered on a streaming service. And that conversation started in late 2014 when Gray put every one of its CBS affiliates up on CBS All Access to join CBS and all of its O&Os. Every single station that we have bought, we've put up on CBS All Access, usually the day of closing. CBS All Access is that's a couple million subscribers. CBS All Access costs money. Obviously, it's now called Paramount Global. All of our signals are there, as are, I believe, every single CBS affiliate in the country. My point is that since late 2014, every single retrans conversation, which is several hundred for us every 3 years, CBS All Access / Paramount Global has been or Paramount Plus has been sitting in the room with us as an elephant. And in 2014, our average retrans rate was $1.40 per Big Four subscriber, and today it's somewhere around $5. So if that elephant in the room has been hurting our negotiations, should we be at $10 now, or is it really irrelevant? Again, I get the talking point, but our signal being available on other platforms for an additional charge has had and will have no impact. You're talking about our distribution in a linear package. We are providing just Gray, but broadcasters, a tremendous amount of value, 365 days a year, 24/7, obviously, not just during an NFL game. And with Monday Night Football, the constant example we hear is it's already on ESPN, and it's been living on ESPN exclusively for essentially 6 years now. So it's not impacting the negotiations. Our signal has been available on Peacock for a year. Every one of our NBC affiliates has been available on Peacock. So how were we and Hearst and Tegna and the little broadcasters and little markets been able to renew all these retrans contracts this year? There were probably 1,000 renewed already this year. If every NBC affiliate is available on Peacock, why didn't every cable operator say, we'll just tell people, if you can't get the NBC station, log out of your linear channel and go to the apps, and then click on the app, wait for Peacock to load, then scroll to NBC and click on that tile, and then watch the NBC channel. And then when you want to change channels and watch something else because there's a commercial on, just log out of the Peacock piece, go back over to linear, scroll back and go through the channel guide to where you want to go. Or God forbid, as my colleague says, he doesn't watch a sport, he watches sports. So, and his team, when he was watching Commander, so I assume they lose a lot. He changed the channel a lot. When there's a bad play, he changes the channel. When the game's more than 15 points, he changes the channel. When there's a commercial, he changes the channel, which I don't like hearing because we saw commercials. he can't do that if he's trying to swap between Peacock and Paramount and Fox on the Comcast bundle. It's not a great user experience. We're selling something in a different distribution platform that has real value for the consumer and real value for the traditional operator. The same way, if I want to get from my house to the airport in D.C., I can take 66 and it'll take me at rush hour about an hour and 25 minutes. Or for the low, low price of anywhere from $7 to $43, I can get in the hot lane and go real fast and pass all the traffic up. I can drive for free, or I can pay money for a different experience. It's the exact same road, the exact same time. And maybe I need to come up with a better analogy here, but we're talking about the same product at the same time, but there's different prices based on how you're going to consume it. And there are a whole bunch of people in D.C. who somehow pay $40 every day each way to commute from Reston, Virginia to D.C. because they don't want to sit in traffic. There's other people that will pay it one time because they really need to get home and get the dog from daycare or from dog care or whatever. People will pay prices for different experiences, and that's the same. It's literally the same way what we're doing here. We're selling a broadcast signal in a linear stream. It's part of a package of channels that people can easily navigate to, and they know they have their viewing patterns, and they can easily navigate around it. That's what we're selling. Our channels are distributed on Peacock, on Hulu, on YouTube, on UVerse, what's left of it, on DirecTV Stream. We were on Sony View the whole time Sony View was operational. And our signals without network content are available on a couple hundred websites, 500-plus FAST channels. You want to watch our Arizona Phoenix AZ3 channel here in Phoenix today, you can watch it on hundreds of platforms, from including all the connected TV devices, all the connected TV manufacturers, your phone, your tablet, even if it's an Android. We even support Android. And you can watch our station here when you're in Hawaii, if you don't want to watch our Hawaii station, or if you're in Maine, if you don't want to watch one of our Maine stations. Our content's out there. The network content's obviously limited. But we are putting our content out in hundreds of different platforms, and some of them get monetized in different ways. And when we're on Comcast, or we're on Direct, or we're on UVerse, or we're on Dish Network, there's different value propositions to the consumer, there's different value propositions to the intermediate company, and there's different propositions to us. And we get compensated every way, sometimes through ads, sometimes through fees, and mostly through both. What we're going to pursue is this company, I think all my peers, are going to continue to pursue every possible distribution method where we can monetize our content the best way we can. Is that a long-winded way of answering your question?
It is, and it's helpful. But just one follow-up on that, but to the extent, so it doesn't sound like it is a concern at the moment that a consumer, a subscriber can watch your content, and that's going to be true even if you're in a dispute with a distributor.
Right. So I'll go back to the very first retrans deal I did was to put the Cox ABC station in Atlanta on Dish Network. And I can't disclose the confidence, but you can assume the fee was less than 5 cents. At the time, Comcast and Charter, then Time Warner in Atlanta, were paying zero for broadcasters. And they got paid 5 cents because they were offering something different. And that changed the world for us, because if Cox didn't get the next deal done with Comcast, they could say, go get our channel from Dish Network. And there's going to be some transaction costs, and people have to pay for Dish Network to transition. And then DirecTV got into the local game, and now we have Hulu, and we have YouTube, and we have All Access. We have, as an industry, we just keep adding distributors in different ways to get our signals. So I am no more concerned when we're in a negotiation with a cable company that someone can get our signal from CBS All Access than they can get our signal from YouTube TV or get our signal from Dish Network. It's actually good for us. I like having alternatives. What I don't see is people going out there saying, hey, you know, cable companies drop Gray's TV station. You can go get them on CBS All Access. It'll cost you, or Paramount Global, it'll cost you $9.99 a month for one channel. Or go get Peacock for $9.99 a month to get the NBC channel, or sign up for Hulu. People aren't really doing that anymore, but we're there. So we do have exclusivity provisions as broadcasters with all the networks. They vary by network. They vary by type of program. They vary by types of days, holdbacks, et cetera. they're absolutely not what the broadcasters would not the ideal that we would like to have. It's not what the networks would like to have. But remember, too, the networks are as invested in this ecosystem as we are. And they're getting, each network is pulling in ballpark $2 billion a year in affiliate fees from us. Their ad revenue is also dependent on us. Remember, half their revenue roughly comes from selling national ads. National ads are sold on eyeballs. If you have Grace Television Station and we're number one in a market, you're going to get more eyeballs for seeing your commercial. You can monetize it better than if you're on another station in a market that doesn't get as many ratings. But if you're not in the market, you get no money. So if Gray hypothetically said we're not going to continue an affiliation with a network, and we distribute 17% of that network's households, the network's going to scramble to find other affiliates to take their place. And I highly doubt any real broadcaster is going to take an affiliation from Gray. We couldn't afford it, they can't afford it. So much more likely that if we don't affiliate with a network because they're charging too much, or they're undercutting us in our exclusivity by deals they're striking with distributors, and we say, you know what, enough is enough, we're not going to affiliate with you, they not just lose our retrans revenue, they're going to lose the reach into our markets. So that's not great from a talent negotiation standpoint. It's not great from calling yourself a network if you can't be in 17% of the homes in America. But it also means you can't monetize those ads. At Gray, at least we over-deliver on ads. But even if we didn't, what if we were just an average broadcaster for each network and we took 17% of their ad revenue out? That's real money. So I get it's really sexy to talk about networks versus affiliates. And we have some really difficult conversations, like everyone does. But at the end of the day, we are also aligned. The five networks, if we include CW, need their affiliates to succeed in the retrans marketplace because they need us for the reach to monetize their advertising, and they need our affiliate fees. And we're not at the point yet where the networks are prepared to say, we're willing to give up about $4 billion a year each from having affiliates, and we want to become TNT. I've never heard a broadcast network say, gee, I'm really jealous of TNT. They don't have to worry about their local affiliates. Not a single one time, and I've been doing this for a long time. There's value in being a broadcast network. It's the retrans fees they get from their O&Os. It's the retrans fees they get from us. It's the advertising they get from their O&Os, and it's the much bigger reach from the affiliates. Remember that every network's reach, 60 to 62% for three of the networks and 78% of ABC's audience reach comes from their affiliates. So if they want to cut us out of the picture and put their content on DTC apps, or become TNT, or become a channel on Disney Plus, they can do that, but they're losing billions of dollars of revenue that supports all of their programming efforts and their entire image and reason for being as a broadcast network. So at the end of the day, we are going to have disagreements about what the holdback period should be on a soap opera and whether there should be live simulcast of a award show. But the reality is that we are all aligned in maximizing retrans revenue, maximizing their audience, and we're not succeeding as well as we all wish we were, but our interests are aligned with the networks in that area. And I know it's not really a happy thought because people like the division, but the reality is they need us to succeed and we need them to succeed. And I think that we are doing a good job and we can do better, and we're, as affiliates, working to do better, but we need the system to survive, and they need the system to survive. So I don't see CBS becoming TNT any more than I see CBS becoming a direct-to-consumer product tomorrow.
Okay. Now, that's great perspective. So much to talk about, so little time. I do want to ask you a question about the other half of the business, the advertising side. It's been a sluggish year plus for advertising, most notably on the national side. I think most of the peer group has reported core flat to down in 2Q. Gray reported 2Q core up 3.5% and guided 3Q core flat to up low single digits. Why are you able to outperform there? And has there been any material change to that outlook since the time you reported 2Q?
You know, we went into this year as contrarian, saying we expected core would probably grow this year. I think everyone on the street told us that we were foolish because the recession was just 6 months away. Happy to say that they were all wrong. Happy to say that Jim was right with the guidance on core. National is a very small part of our business. It's 20% or less of all of our advertising revenue. We have not seen national particularly strong in quite a while. I think it's stronger, at least for us, than we had expected, because auto is doing actually pretty well. Again, the strikes have had no impact on us. If anything, the three with strikes are saving a little bit of money and has some inventory building up, and their competitors are looking to expand their market share. So auto is doing well for us. National overall isn't doing – it's not falling off a cliff. Our advertising is pretty stable this year. As I said, we expect it to grow a little bit this year. Can't speak to our peers' performance. What I'd say for us is that we tend to have leading TV stations. They tend to have higher rates than peers. If there is a slowdown, we have seen in the past that the advertisers tend to reallocate dollars before they cut them, meaning they'll cut out some platforms, maybe cut out some TV stations, maybe not advertise, do some outdoor, maybe cut back on radio or something else. Before they start cutting the budget, they'll just reallocate. And as number one station in the market, they typically see the impact less. And as the economy gets stronger and confidence increases at a local level, the number one station tends to bounce back more quickly as well. So we have a good portfolio. And certainly without the actual long-promised recession, they've done pretty well this year.
Okay. Any early thoughts on political next year? And, you know, one thing we've talked about last cycle, we saw shifting spending from traditionally competitive markets to more solidly blue or solidly red markets. Do you expect to see that again in the coming election, this one being a presidential election? And what are your expectations broadly
last year we had two weird things happen. We had a bunch of candidates who won primaries in July and August and then promptly stopped spending and went dark on the air. And we have never, ever seen a major candidate in a competitive race go dark after primary. Typically, you spend a lot of money when the primary and the day after, you now introduce yourself as a moderate, to, or at least somewhat more moderate, to attract people to your campaign, including the people who voted against you in the primary. And instead, we had a bunch of high-profile races where they just literally went off the air for all of August and a good part of September. And we kept hearing they were coming back in 2 weeks. The super PACs pulled back, and those races certainly hurt us. When the money generally came back in October, is what you were saying, we saw money moving in places that made no political sense. If you think you know something about politics, and I lived in D.C. for a couple decades, so I kind of think I do, Washington State is not a place where Patty Murray is going to lose her fifth election for U.S. Senate, no matter what a crazy couple polls say. It's just not going to happen. And yet, there was a poll or two that said that she might be in danger, and money moved to Washington State in a pretty significant amount. And money moved to Oregon, which is also pretty blue. And money moved to Oklahoma, to a governor's race that it's about as red state as you can find. The beneficiaries of this money moving around were primarily New York, Philadelphia, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, places where Gray has zero presence at all. Portland, our Portland station actually did shockingly well because of that, but that's the only station we have in Oregon. And the markets that were particularly competitive had money sort of drained out of them. So I think as when we went through the collective we, Washington, went through an analysis after the election of what the heck happened, because those supposedly competitive races that broke in October that got a bunch of money to move turned out to be completely rolled out exactly as you would have predicted in the polls that we had in place in June and July. It appears there were a couple of real outlier polls that came out in basically August, September, and a lot of political money followed those. The polls may or may not have been done the way that traditional polls are done. It may have potentially been funded by candidates who are trying to get some headlines, and it absolutely worked. And therefore, if you look, your polls start turning in a direction, the money starts flowing from donors and from PACs and super PACs. So some of that seemed to have been a little bit of playing the game last year, and we were hurt based on, again, our geography of being in more politically competitive places and not deeply blue and deeply red. I don't really see that happening again. Polls are a very tricky business. Ask Hillary Clinton. They haven't gotten any better. A lot fewer people use landlines now than they did in 2016. So it's really, really a hard business. And I don't mean to suggest in any way I understand how polling is done or should be done. But I know that there is some accepted polls out there, and there are some that are not so accepted. And I think that the dollars next year are going to follow the polls that follow more accepted methods and procedures.
Okay. Kevin, I wish we had more time, but we are out of time. Thank you very much for doing this. This is helpful.
Appreciate your time.